Hello there, and welcome to the podcast. It's John Markar here, and I thought I'd just jump in with a very quick but very important message that I wanted to share with you before you delve into this episode of the Driven Chat podcast. This podcast, the Driven Chat podcast, has now come to an end. But don't worry, I'm not going to stop you from listening to this episode or from catching up with the 185 episodes that we've recorded in this format. I just wanted to let you know that if you're looking for our new episodes recorded after December 2023, then you'll need to seek out our new podcast, The Driven Podcast. You can find The Driven Podcast in all the usual podcast platforms, including, chances are, the one that you're listening to this one on right now. So please do enjoy this episode, share it with a friend by all means. But when it's done, don't forget to search for the new podcast, The Driven Podcast, and subscribe to the new format to hear the new stuff. To make life easy, head on over to the Driven website via driven.site. There you will find links through to the new podcast, including links to your preferred podcast platform. And hey, whilst you're there, why not check out everything else we do, including hand-picked automotive news stories, car and bike reviews, video features, and even more. For now, though, I'll let you enjoy this episode, and I will remind you again at the end of the episode, but for the future reference, this message is approximately 1 minute and 30 seconds long. That's 6 clicks on the 15-second skip button. Enjoy!
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
The Driven Chat podcast in association with Paramex Digital. You dream it, we bring it to life. Find out more at drivenchat.com.
Hello, welcome to the latest Driven Chat podcast. I've completely forgotten what the hashtag I've been trying to peddle for ages is. Something along the lines of brew up and tune in or something.
That's
but it. Tune in makes no sense because it's a podcast. You don't tune into a podcast. You press play. Brew up and press play. Wait, listen.
That's quite good. That's all right. It's an evolving hashtag.
We're morphing like the virus. That's the South African variant of the Driven Chat hashtag. Listen, hi, how are you doing? Really excited for today's show because we've got a proper Formula One driver on the show today who also happens to have been in Formula E and various other Le Mans, etc., etc. A proper, proper cool guy as well, a guy I really, really like. But before we get to the guy I really, really like, we get to two people I absolutely love. The marvellous Monsieur Markar himself. It's John Markar.
Hello, hello, hello. Hello to you. Hello to the listener. Hello to everyone. Hello, everyone.
He's very good at saying hello. He's been practicing hellos this week. And the sensation that is, I accidentally, Amy, called you Amy Shaw Photography at the end of the, Andy J podcast the other day because that's your hashtag or your at or whatever. I would just like to say you are not in my phone as Amy Shaw Photography.
I think when I first met you, you went into my phone as Andy J, the presenter man, or something along those lines.
I mean, it's that's all right. I'm sure I'm down in a few phones is quite a lot worse. Anyway, Amy Shaw.
Hello, hello, hello.
Do you know, have you ever noticed yourself saved as anything random? Like, for example, this is a tangent I wasn't expecting. I went in my wife's phone a couple of days ago. Because she has developed what we describe as a silly celebrity crush, celebrity crush that really is nonsense because it's not worthy of crushness, okay? And that is, she has developed a crush on Gangs of London actor Joe Cole, who is not a handsome man, in my humble opinion. However, she's having this strange tangent on it, so I have changed my name in her phone to Joe Cole.
I like that.
Yeah, that works. But do you ever, like, I've looked through my phone, I've got a couple of people who have maybe worked with in the past that I've not particularly liked necessarily, or I've thought they're a bit strange. So I've then saved them in my phone as creepy person's name, and then have been working with them again in the future, trying to avoid them. Yeah. And then they're like, oh, let me just quickly just send you a message or whatever. I'm like, and just tried to hide my phone.
Yes, yeah. I'm like you. I have a handful of names that the first word in them it begins with a T and then sounds quite a lot like hat. So, yeah. And there's about 20 of them, and I have worked with a few subsequently as well.
I wonder if
and they don't get changed. No. It just gets reinforced. Yeah, no, but you're still a tea hat.
But John, everybody likes you and you seem to like everybody. So I bet you've just got, oh, this lovely person that I worked with once in my phone.
I think the obscurity of names saved in my phone is probably limited to people that I've either bought or sold a car to. So there's a guy in my phone that I mean, occasional contact with, who's saved as Barry M3 because I bought an M3 off of Barry once upon a time. There's lots of people like that. And I very rarely change names. I don't know if anyone else does this, but once somebody's saved in your phone as whatever, then that's just how they stay, isn't it? So yeah, there's Barry M3. I think there's Neil Royal Enfield. There's all sorts of people like that in my phone because I've either bought or sold something to them or from them. But can we revisit the celebrity crush thing? I'm fascinated by your wife's new celebrity crush, Andy, because I recently...
Sure. We will talk about cars and lots of cool racing. So
yeah, cars are coming. But so up until recently, I haven't really had a celebrity crush. But as our avid listeners will know, if you've been around from day one with Driven and Driven Chat and the various... angles and avenues which we have, be that videos and podcasts, you'll know that we have a sister podcast, which is aptly named the Andy J podcast. And that works from Andy's radio show, but it's bigger and better with extended conversations. And as well as cutting and editing and putting together the Driven Chat podcast, which I do, I also do some work on the Andy J podcast. So I get to listen to Andy talking to these lovely celebrities each week. Now, recently, Andy on the Andy J podcast interviewed a lady who I wasn't all that familiar with up until the podcast, but subsequently she has become my new celebrity crush. And I'm wondering if you know who I'm talking about, Andy, because I don't think I've told you this up until
you haven't.
But you recently interviewed a lady called Nicola Thorpe, who is...
Isn't she amazing?
I fell in love with Nicola Thorpe whilst listening to her on your podcast, whilst editing it, in fact. Bear in mind, so to edit a podcast, you have to listen through and you listen to conversations, you listen again, and then you listen for audio peaks and things. I actually listened to the podcast episode again, despite that I'd listened to it probably six times already. I listened to the episode when it was published because I knew that I'd be able to listen to Nicola Thorpe again. I'm besotted. Wow. I'm besotted. Aww.
And that'll explain the spike in listeners, John. It's had a listen this week. Wow.
Yeah. No.
I thought it was just a Sun journalist. Oh, amazing. No, listen, I'm with you. In fact, Amy, you have met Nicola Thorpe because she is the lovely lady who came to the truck on the day of the Sophie Ellis-Bextor interview.
Yes, I remember Nicola. Yeah. She's lovely.
She's the one that you were like, oh, I think I've got a crush on her. And I was like, do you, Ames? Wow.
A little bit of one.
And then I said to you about 10 minutes later, I think I've got a crush on her too. So turns out John also has a crush on Nicola Thorpe. No, listen, I kind of know exactly where you're coming from. Not only was she utterly captivating, she was phenomenally honest. She has dealt with some incredible issues in her life and stood up to aplomb. I was trying to convince her to run for prime minister. I was so impressed with her as a human being, never mind the fact that she's, you know, a sensational person. So, yeah, I would endorse that, John. If it weren't for the fact that you already have a wonderful girlfriend who I think is an angel, if it wasn't for that, I would be giving you Nicola's number.
In
as
my
it stands, you can't have it.
In the openness and honesty of our relationship, I have already disclosed that Nicola Thorpe is now top tier celebrity, you know, the unattainable celebrity crush level. And she's fine with that. I think her exact words were, do you know, it's quite humbling that you're not going for the ridiculous supermodels. You know, Nicola Thorpe's an attractive lady, but she's not who you might think of as, you know, Victoria's Secret's model-esque.
Oh, she's a good looking woman.
But yeah, but it was it was her conversation that really made me go, oh, wow, this is a nice lady.
Fun Nicola Thorpe fact for you that you may or may not have got from the podcast. I can't remember. She lives on a houseboat.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Well, her Instagram is something like the barge captain or something like that. Because, she lives on a barge.
All right, stalker.
Should we talk about cars?
Or something like that.
I mean, this is the key question, John. Has she followed back?
No, and I don't think I followed her, actually. I wasn't that creepy. But yeah.
That's even worse. You know her tag, but you don't follow.
Well, that's, I can explain. Wait, I can explain. No, it's because of course we can use Instagram photos because they're copyright free. So when I need to do some artwork for your podcast, I can steal them off Instagram. But that's it. Anyway, let's talk about cars quickly.
Oh no, that's a fun. That is a fun celebrity confession. I'm gonna ask you one car question, then I'm coming to you, Amy, with your celebrity crush. Okay.
I'm just, yep.
You have forewarning there.
Okay.
So here is my car question for you. The Ferrari Roma, is it basically an absolute rip-off of the F-Type?
I can see the logic in that.
It's a yes or no question.
I'm going to say really. No.
I'm going to give on that note.
I'm going to say no, but interesting because, of course, the F-Type was loosely a follow-on from the E-Type, and, of course, the E-Type was the car that Enzo Ferrari described as the most beautiful car in the world. And then there were some quite sneaky little design cues that you saw on Ferraris for the next 10 years that you could have said, hey, he's got that. That's come from the E-Type. So, they say history repeats itself. Perhaps somebody in the design studios at Ferrari saw the F-Type and thought, that's quite pretty. I wonder if we can do something similar. But I say no, it's not a rip-off, but I do get
very, very closely inspired by. When I first saw the Roma, I was like, oh, gosh, that's gorgeous. Mm. They released photographs, didn't they, about, like, what, 2 years ago, something like that? I was like, that's really nice.
Very lovely.
And then I saw the price, thinking it would be, like, an affordable because two words that don't generally go together. And I think it was probably an F-Type charging past me, and I was like, oh, is that a Roma? And you know, I've had an F-Type, I love them, I think they're really, really gorgeous, and they've got great bums. And there's just a lot of similarity for me, like an awful lot. Maybe I'm completely wrong. Amy, celebrity crush, go.
Henry Cavill.
Okay, that's kind of standard.
Yeah, I know, but he's a very pretty man. Or if there was going to be
The only way that would be exciting, Ames, is if that was a proper twist on it, which would be him as the Witcher.
Well, with the long white hair or grey hair, whatever. I mean, I probably still would. Yep, probably would. But then, I mean, okay, all right. I'll do girl crush. If I had to do girl crush, have you watched Living With Yourself with Paul Rudd?
No.
Who's?
Yeah. You're talking about
her. Irish. Yeah, yes. A comedian.
Yes.
Funny.
Whose name? Aisling B.
Yes, that's it.
I know who she is.
She's sensational. She's lovely. She's hilarious. It's very
so funny.
Very funny.
Yep. Just she's been popping up on my TikTok, and I'm like, you know what? You're a very funny, lovely lady. So
she is. Yep. She's funny and lovely. Yeah. Yeah. She's had a fascinating life. She lost her dad very young, and it's plagued her. To be fair. And she's written extensively about it. Don't know why I went down that road. No, you know who Henry Cavill is dating, Ames?
No,
you probably do, because you probably... Nicola Thorpe.
No.
You're joking.
I am.
Yeah.
But if you...
The look on your respective faces is glorious.
But I do urge you, the listener, obviously, once you've finished listening to our podcast here, head over to the Andy J podcast and have a listen. It's not car stuff. There's occasionally some car mentioned, but there is some really, really great conversations to be had. And just find the Nicola Thorpe episode. Let me know what you reckon.
And by the way, what John is saying is listen to the episode. Don't just Google search her.
Oh, yeah, no, because that's the crucial thing. It's, for me, the conversation made me go, oh, wow, this is a... remarkable.
She's on the episode, to make it easy to find, she's on quite a recent episode with Richard Blackwood and Tina Barrett from Escape 7.
I think, if my memory serves me correctly, it's episode 35.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But that's what you get for sitting at a desk audio editing for hours and hours.
Very well.
I'm going to tell Nicola, John.
That's fine. That's fine. I don't mind.
I don't mind at all.
I have no shame.
Tell us about today's show. This show, the Driven Chat. The Driven Chat.
This podcast. One. Well, yeah, we've got, as you said, an actual F1 driver, but not only an F1 driver, a Formula E driver. And I think he harps back in the conversation talking about the fact that he's driven multiple F1 cars from all different eras.
He said from every era of F1.
Wow.
Which is amazing. Absolutely amazing. Yeah. I think most people, really cool. Certainly if you're of the younger generation, you will know Karun, who we're talking about, Karun Chanduk, as a pundit for, he's done a bit of work with Channel 4. He now does the Formula One presenting for Sky.
He's done Five Live and various
things. Yeah,
he's
done all sorts of wonderful things. And of course, there is nothing better than having a voice of authority in a field of expertise, in this case, motorsport, when you've actually been a racing driver. You know, what I find so compelling about the way that he commentates and presents is that he can put everything into layman's terms. It doesn't matter if you've been watching Formula One for 20 years or this is the first time you've ever watched it. He has a very compelling way of just explaining everything in the right way that doesn't alienate either the newbies or the people that have been watching and listening and engaging for many, many years. It's a talent, which I think it can only be a natural talent. I can't imagine you can teach that sort of thing.
It's a very good point, actually, John. And the other thing about him is, as you say, you know, even if you are an absolute F1 anorak and you understand downforce and how the cars work and the various different variables going on in every single car in every single team, he still knows more than you.
Yeah.
But he doesn't patronize you about that. You know, he just explains it. So even if you get it, you get more because he gets it better.
That's right.
He's great.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm looking forward to listening to this.
Good.
He sounds great.
He is good. He's a good lad. Maybe we should just dive straight in.
The Driven Chat podcast in association with Paramex Digital.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello and welcome to yet another episode of the Driven Chat podcast. This week we have another incredible guest. I'd love to introduce you to Karun Chanduk.
Hello, nice to be here.
How are you doing, Karun?
I don't think anyone's ever called me incredible before, but I'll take it.
I refuse to believe that.
Very happy to be here. Always nice to chat.
Fantastic. And of course, we have Andy Jay joining us as well. I know that you and Andy have some history. That sounds quite sinister, doesn't it? You have history as friends.
let's get a rumour going, shall we? Taking the automotive televisual world by storm. There's a quiet whisper. Karun, you said you've never been called incredible, right? Which has just immediately made my mind go to Hulk. Okay, I'm just going here. We're going to talk cars and racing and your phenomenal career. Of course, we're talking about all these things, but a little bit of nonsense to start with because it's one of my favorite questions in the world. If you were a superhero, which of the superheroes would you be?
Well, obviously, Batman. I mean, he drives the Batmobile. You know, Batman is my favorite superhero, unquestionably. My wife is a bit concerned that I've got four different Batman t-shirts. She doesn't get it. She's like, why does any grown adult need four Batman t-shirts? And I iron them as well. She's like, you know, it's like,
You were straight. There was no thinking about that. That was my favorite thing. You were straight with, it's Batman. It's obviously Batman. Like, I've been trying to, one of my friends is working on the Batman movie. They're just finishing the Robert Pattinson Batman movie. And he's told me some bits about the Batmobile that I'm not allowed to reveal. But one of my other friends designed the original Batmobile that was the Dark Knight Batmobile.
Oh, wow.
And my favourite fact about it, because he's got little bits of it that didn't, you know, that were in the kind of test models and whatnot. My favourite fact about it is inside where the steering wheel is, they've got a bat symbol with all dark, black and grey, with the Union Jack on it.
What? Why has it got the Union Jack on it?
Because it was made by Brits.
I've seen that. Somebody else, I'm sure there's a photo of it somewhere that's there. Yeah, somebody shared that image, which is quite a nice little, it's a very unobvious thing, isn't it? A little unobvious design quirk.
It's really cool. It's just a little thing.
Yeah.
So my buddy, his name's Noah Meddings, and he's, you can look him up. He is a legend in the special effects world. And yeah, he designed that Batmobile, which I think is very cool.
Fantastic.
See, I tell you what, I do enjoy the randomness of your podcast. You know, that's one of the things with lockdown, isn't it, this year? We've all got into all these podcasts and you know, because we're stuck at home, and because I'm Indian and I don't go cycling outdoors in the winter, I've worn the turbo trainer and I put the podcast on and I've been listening to all sorts. And I do enjoy the randomness of your podcast, I've got to say.
Well, thanks, man. I think the secret for me is I don't plan anything. I basically just make anything up as it goes along. And most people having conversations would tell you that is completely the wrong thing to do. You should have written questions and you should follow them in order and you should la-di-da. I'd rather just listen to what's coming up and chat about it.
You know? Yeah, I mean, well, you got to do what works for you. I think winging, if you're able to wing it, I mean, that's a talent on its own, isn't it? Coming from the world of live television or wearing that hat, that's basically what we have to do, isn't it? You are winging it. There is no script to live TV.
Yeah, exactly. So if people wondering how we have met before, it was it Channel 5, Formula E?
At the time, I think it was, yeah. Yeah, was this, in season one, it was on Channel 5, wasn't it? Yeah.
I think it was Channel 5. It was either ITV or Channel 5. And I was anchoring and you were my guest. But you couldn't make qualifying for some reason. For whatever reason, they sent someone else in to kind of cover you. And then you came in for the main race, if I remember rightly. And for some reason, we were in a broom cupboard. We were in like the smallest studio I've ever been in. And it was absolutely bizarre. And you totally blew me away, not just with your insight and your knowledge and your reading of the race and the situations and the personalities and all of that kind of stuff. But moreover as well, the things you were able to tell me in the adverts and whatnot, Corinne, you are so connected, man. The number of people you were able to say, oh, well, you know, I was doing this thing for Williams the other day, or I was chatting to them, or I was making this. You make deals happen as well behind the scenes, don't you? I mean, we're going straight in here. You're the deal maker.
Well, I don't know if that's the word. I'd be my bank balance would look a lot better if I was the deal maker that you're making me sound. But I think look, we're very lucky in the sport. You know, we've got some amazing people and characters from a very wide range of backgrounds within the sport. They've done a lot of different things in different verticals, as I like to call it, whether it's Formula One or rallying or sports cars or you know, the engineering side or the commercial side or the driving, you know, there's so many different aspects to motorsport in general. I think we're very lucky. And I enjoy learning about all the different parts of our sport. And therefore, part of that journey is to speak to people. You know, when I walk through the paddock with Anthony Davidson or Damon Hill, they often look at me and say, you know, do you not know anybody? Is there literally anybody in this paddock that you don't know or, you know, haven't got a story with? Because I just enjoy talking to people and, you know, learning about what they do and what their story is and what they bring to the sport and what they're able to contribute to their team, for example, or their role within Formula One or Formula E, whatever. So, yeah, I think listen, we're so lucky, aren't we, in this business of motorsport that there's some great characters.
Well, look, you know, I would say another part of that, Corinne, is because of the sheer breadth of experience you've had, you know, from British Formula 3 and GP2 to, of course, your time in Formula 1 and Formula E and Le Mans, et cetera, et cetera. You know, you've been there, done that, got the T-shirt, got the race suit, got the helmet. You have earned your stripes. You've been at every level of this incredible sport and you have done it across the board. So let me go in with this one from the very beginning, Corinne, because I've never asked you this and I'm utterly fascinated. You know what it's like going flat out in a Formula 1 car in a race, in an F1 race. How fast is that compared to, because this is the big question everybody always asks, compared to going flat out in Formula E? Is it just insanely faster? Is it just like next level faster?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, the reality is if you put the Formula E car on the same track, let's take a generic track like Barcelona or Silverstone, there will be 20 seconds probably in between them. You know, I'd say somewhere between 15 to 20 seconds. I haven't exactly worked it out, but it'll be something like that. So, you know, you're not talking a small amount of lap time. There's pretty significant amount of lap time there. But it's a totally and I think there's room for them to coexist in this world in the same way that Le Mans and sports cars and NASCAR and IndyCar and Formula One all coexisted, right? You know, I think, and this was a mistake that a lot of people made in year one, which was drawing the comparisons between Formula One and Formula E. I'm a purist. I believe Formula One should and will always be the pinnacle of our sport. It should have the fastest cars, the best drivers. You know, it's got to be the pinnacle of our sport. It's the aspirational value of that is so high. It's been built over 70 years of this sport. But that doesn't mean that there has to be an either-or situation. You know, it doesn't mean that the others can't coexist. And I think that's what we have now with Formula E, where it's just a different type of racing. You know, it's going to urban areas where perhaps Formula One can't, because they're so fast, right? Because the cars are so quick, you can't race them on the narrower street circuits or the smaller confines of an airport apron like they do in Berlin with Formula E, for example. So, you know, I think it's just a different form of motorsport, and we have to separate it.
No, you're absolutely right. And I'm certainly not knocking, by the way, you know, I love Formula E. I'm not knocking that. I'm just intrigued by, I kind of, what I'm always fascinated by when it comes to talking to racers like yourself is that feeling of speed that thrills you, that thing that gets you. I mean, and this is where I'm coming from, Karun. If you can remember the first time, for example, you were allowed to go flat out. Was it Red Bull that were your first F1 team, yep, test driver for them? Can you remember? Because obviously you'd done so well.
Oh, absolutely. I can remember the first lap I drove in Barcelona. You know, it's the first lap you drive in a Formula One car, the first time you drive in a Formula One car, it sits with you forever. You know, it is the culmination of a dream. And it is, even the car, and this is the part that's hard to explain to people at home, even the crappy car at the back of the grid, you know, when I drove with two teams that were at the back of the grid, in Hispania and Lotus, but they were still faster than any other car on the planet. They're still quicker than the fastest hypercar on the planet. They're still quicker than a Formula 2 car. They're still quicker than an Indy car. You know, it is still, around a normal lap, it is still one of the top 10 fastest cars on the planet. And that is just remarkable at F1. You know, they're just so quick and so agile, and the technology involved in it is just brilliant.
I've heard a few remarks from Formula One drivers. You're the first time we've had a guest on our podcast that's had the luxury to be a Formula One driver and drive those cars. But I've heard an anecdote that a few people have mentioned, which is that driving a Formula One car in comparison to most other cars is almost like flying, because it's so dependent on downforce.
Yeah.
And I guess if you also fly, then that would make a lot of sense. You can make those comparisons. But if you don't, then I guess it's going to be more difficult. But would you agree with that statement?
Yeah, it is. But obviously the other way around, you know, they're looking for the wings to lift them up, yeah, whereas we need the wings to push us down. So,
yeah.
But yeah, listen, aerodynamics plays such a big role. And in fact, I discovered that in Formula 3, you know, when I first came to the UK to race, you suddenly realize that the faster you go, the better the car feels. Mm. And you have to, it sort of screws your head up, to be honest, because you're going, well, the car's moving around, and your natural immediate instinct is to back off, mm-hmm, the power and go, oh, this doesn't feel right, because I'm about to spin. But actually what you've got to do is go even quicker, and then the downforce starts to work, and you know, then things start to work better. So yeah, it's a funny thing you have to learn with time and experience. But I think, you know, I've been lucky now to have driven 21 different Formula One cars in every decade, and one from, I think, every decade of the sport, I'm right in saying, wow, right from the 50s. So
that's cool, man. That's cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. So to have experienced a car from every decade of the sport, and including, you know, 7 cars that have won the world championship. So in that year, they were the best car on the planet. It's been fantastic. You know, I'm so, so lucky to have ticked so many of the things off my bucket list.
I have to ask, because I'm sure there will be listeners at home that will be wanting to know the answer to this question as well. Having driven all of those different eras, where's the pinnacle for you? because I know a lot of people get grumpy about the newer cars and the lack of sound, and there's undoubtedly still the fastest. But is it for you, the is the good stuff the noisy stuff? Is it the real classic stuff? What tops it for you?
I think there's two things. One is from an emotional standpoint, I'd say the early 90s, I think, was brilliant for F1 because the cars were simplistic, but they looked beautiful. And maybe it's because, you know, I think we're all roughly of a similar age and we grew up in that era, didn't we, watching your Mansells and Prosts and Sennas and those people. So you emotionally connect with that. But I think in terms of the pinnacle, to answer your question, I would still say 2004 was the pinnacle of Formula One. Yeah. You know, you had the big V10 engines. I drove Montoya's car from 2004. You know, the BMW engine was 956 horsepower, the one that I drove. 20,000 RPM, you know, screaming. And I remember I used to live in Brackley in Northamptonshire. I was, 8 miles away from Silverstone. And I remember hearing the cars testing at Silverstone. I could hear it in my bedroom. And then I get in my road car and whiz up there to go see them. And I think, you know, that's, you'd get goosebumps, wouldn't you, when you'd hear the cars before you could see them, the screaming banshee coming at you.
You could argue that that time of the that time of the automotive industry as a whole was the pinnacle, really, wasn't it? That's when manufacturers were producing the crazy big engine cars with big horsepower. It was just before people really started reining in on carbon emissions and noise and people really actually caring about how much fuel they were putting in cars. I think that that's kind of like a peak for me as well in the general world of automotive.
Yeah, but I think in F1, the other thing is the weight of it. You know, at that time, the cars were only 605 kilos, as opposed to now they're going to be 752 now this year. So, you know, 150 kilos in Formula One terms is colossal. And if you compare from, you know, that 2004 car, that's 25% of the car you've added on top in terms of weight, which is something that's not often talked about. And, you know, having driven a car from 2004 and then having driven Lewis's car from 2019, the difference in weight and agility is massive. And I think we, you know, that's something that has, again, been a bit of a minus mark, I think, in the sport. But that's the way we've gone, isn't it? With the hybrids and the batteries, you know, there's a weight factor that comes with all of that. And we're not going to go back, unfortunately.
Yes, it's a funny old time. I've been trying to understand, because of course, plenty of our listeners, and I know John's no stranger to a track day. Even I have, you know, been allowed to take something around Silverstone, which was nice and fast and exciting, and wow, that's what speed feels like. But I don't think, there'll be very few people listening to this, and I'm including John in this, perhaps rightly or wrongly, John, you can correct me if you like, who have experienced it in a single-seater environment, an open-top single-seater, and that's kind of, that's what I want to, if there's some way you can try and describe that to us, Corinne, because I keep sort of telling people, you don't really know what speed feels like until you are going 100, 150 miles an hour with just a helmet for protection. You know, it's I've never done it, but it just feels to me to be something that you've got to have balls of steel to do.
You've got to experience certain things to get that feeling in your belly, isn't it? You know, on one hand, people say, oh, it's like going on a roller coaster. But it's not, because on a roller coaster, all you're doing is sitting in a seat and hanging on. And yeah, it's exciting as it goes in all these different directions, but it's not the same. Here you're controlling this thing, and you're actually, Damon Hill used a brilliant analogy the other day on a podcast I was listening to, where, you know, he's talking about what the cliff edge of, you're on the edge of grip, right? You're on this knife edge. You're on the precipice of having the grip to go around the corner on the very edge of adhesion and falling off that cliff, which means you're going spinning and off into the gravel or into the wall. And, you know, look, you know, when you were all in school, I don't know if you had these sort of chairs, but when I grew up in India, we had these chairs, which, you know, you had these sort of wooden legs and you'd rock back and forth in your chair. And there'd be that point where you take your hands off your desk and you'd either go, whoa, and you're about to fall over backwards, or you come back forward. And that's what it's like, that little buzz you get in your stomach, in your head of, ooh, got away with it. You know, you feel that at every single corner, but at going at a very high speed. And that's, you know, that's just a small example of trying to give somebody some this example of exhilaration, I guess, is the word, isn't it? That you've got away with it somehow.
That's such a fantastic analogy that I've never, ever, ever thought of or heard anyone else describe. But the balancing on the chair thing is absolutely spot on. I can't really, I have driven single-seater cars, but nothing at great speed. Oh. My comparison would be riding superbikes, I guess, would be a comparison.
Yeah.
At the point that you're kind of leaning into a corner, there does come a point where you're going at a certain speed, at a certain trajectory, you know, with a different to a car. Once you've committed to a line on a corner on a bike, you can't then just change. You can't just change your line like you can in a car because the way that physics works. But that is such an amazing analogy, the swinging on a chair thing. And we can all think back to being told off by our teachers, can't we, at school? I can remember it vividly.
Yeah, well, I'll have to give Damon credit for that, you know, but I thought it was very good. But I mean, listen, it's like everything in life, isn't it? You know, I just before winter fully set in, I went on a bike ride, decided to try a new route, ended up going down this hill. And at one point I looked at the speed of my bike and I was doing 82 kilometers an hour, which is quite fast on a road bike.
Yeah.
And you're going downhill and you're going, I'm not quite sure where this road stops and the bike's wobbling underneath you. And yeah, in the grand scheme of it, you're only doing 50 miles an hour, which, you know, in a car you wouldn't even think about. But that's what I'm saying. It's all in. You have to take it in context. You know, when you're on skinny tires,
you hit a pothole.
Yeah, exactly.
You hit a pothole on a road bike, on a pedal bike, presumably we're talking about. Yeah, in real trouble.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So I think, you know, there are ways for people to experience that feeling of exhilaration, you know, from trying different experiences in life. You don't have to do it in a single-seater race car. It's ultimately. It's hard to explain, though, isn't it? Until you've actually experienced those butterflies in your stomach of going, oh, God, this is feeling a bit scary here, or not.
I don't think my constitution would survive it. I think I'd have to run to the toilet all the time. I mean, it is that scary.
No, it's not. This is the thing. It's exhilarating, you know. It's not scary because it's by the time you've climbed the ladder into driving something that quick, whether it's a GP2 or a Formula 2 car or a Formula 1 car, you've driven other stuff before. You know, you've driven F4 and F3 and right. things like that. So the human brain is exceptional at getting used to it. I mean, I remember, you know, there's certain moments where I've got into a race car and gone, oh my God, this is properly scary. And one of them, I suppose the standout one was when I did my first GP2 test, actually, in Jerez, the end of 2006. I remember going down the back straight, and it was the first time I got to full throttle, and my head just went in the headrest, and I thought, oh, my, this is just uncontrollable. This is not possible. I can't believe how quick it is. But by lap five, you've gotten over that. You know, your brain has adjusted, and you've automatically started sort of this correctional course in your head of what is the acceptable limit of speed and threshold of grip, etc., and your brain adjusts. And by the time you get to your 10th lap, you want more power because you've gotten used to that bit. And I think, yeah, so there's still those moments when you get into something which blows you. I mean, when I first drove a Can-Am McLaren, I raced this Can-Am car at Goodwood at the Revival, a 1965 McLaren. And that was the same. You know, it's got so much power and so much torque. It's got a 7-litre engine in it or something. And on the opening, on the first lap, you just think, this is just impossible because you're on cross-ply Dunlop tyres and there's just no grip. And it's just an accident waiting to happen at every corner. But, you know, you get used to it and you get your head around it and you learn. But it has to come with experience.
The Can-Am cars are absolutely nuts, man. I mean, there's what a shame that had to stop for various reasons.
But you can see why.
Yeah, you can understand why. You know, you are sitting there surrounded by fuel thinking, this cannot be safe.
Yeah. But incredible to watch. I mean, you know, it's still
incredible to drive. And this is the funny thing, right? Nowadays, with the evolution of engineering and technology, you know, the cars these days have more power than they had in period although the chassis are the same. You know, the engines are all going back to dynos and getting modified and things like that. So I did enjoy it. I raced it twice at Goodwood. I won the race there in 2019, and it was brilliant. It was just so much fun to do.
Yeah, it's amazing. So, I mean, given these kind of extremes of highs that you have in your career, you know, getting into these cars, doing these speeds, having this kind of exhilarating fear that is a part and parcel of a racer's life, how do you match those highs in the real world, out of the cars?
You can't, really. But I think that's the same with any sport, isn't it? You know, that's why you often find athletes from the Olympics or other forms of sport, when they've stopped competing, you know, their mental health struggles because they need to find something to focus their mind on and find the next thing. You know, I've been very fortunate, I guess, that I've, you know, right back from 2004, started this parallel career in television. So it meant that as the driving opportunities have slowed down for a variety of reasons, I've still got my mental stimulation from doing other things. You know, I've been lucky to be doing television and columns and podcasts and all sorts of different things around Formula One and motorsport in general and documentaries and things like that. So it's meant that I've got mental stimulation from something else. But it is very hard to replace. And you know, I'm sure when you talk to, if you talk to someone like Chris Hoy, for example, you know, he's gone from cycling to doing motor racing and it's replaced some of the buzz. But when you can imagine it, can't you? You're sitting there watching someone like Rebecca Adlington or Victoria Pendleton, London 2012, home crowd going bonkers for them. You can't replace that buzz. You know, how can you replace the buzz of Super Saturday from the London Olympic Stadium from that day? Yeah. Mo Farah or Jessica Ennis are never going to be able to replace that and in their day-to-day life. But it's about coming to terms with it. It's about coming to terms with that maybe you don't need to replace that and you just find other things in life that make you happy and give you satisfaction.
Do you know what? Chris Hoy is a really, really good example because I know Chris a fair bit, actually. We've met many, many times now. And I've said this to him, and I'll get your take on it as well, Corinne, because I think, as you, we all know, his prowess on two wheels was second to none. I mean, he was unbelievable. At the time, he was the greatest ever Olympian, phenomenal. And like you say, he went into racing. And for me, he landed a seat at Le Mans far too soon. It was far too soon. It was far too early in his racing journey. And it gave him an unfair view of what it's like to work through the ranks. I know he then went back and did his kind of Sterns in Caterhams and Ginettas and so on and so forth, but it was, what, second season in a race car he's racing at Le Mans?
Yeah, I guess so. But I mean, it's a funny business, isn't it? You know, I think there was a lot of marketing stuff that went along with it and sort of drove him into that. And you're not going to give up the opportunity to do Le Mans when it comes calling. So, you know, I don't think that's something he would regret.
No, that's fair. Well, look, let's talk about you because, of course, you are from a very rich history, a family of racers. I believe.
I was a bit concerned when you said very rich because I was like, you've not done your research here.
I'm talking about pedigree. I don't mean finances. I haven't done a deep delve into your bank balance. But, you know, am I right in saying your granddad and your grandmum were both kind of big racers?
You know, my granddad started the federation in India, and he was one of the prime movers behind getting the sport going when, you know, the British left India basically in the late, you know, 1947, and we got independence. And then my grandfather and my grandmother did some racing, I think, in the 70s. My dad started racing in 1972 and did a lot of rallying as well. I grew up in a motor racing family back in India.
You're sort of selling your dad's credits a little short there. Did a lot of rallying. He was the multiple Indian rally champion, wasn't he?
Yeah, and you know, he did
a lot. He was all right.
No, he did a lot of racing and rallying between sort of, I think, as I said, 1972, and I think he stopped in about 2000. So Yeah, nearly 30 years that he raced and rallied all sorts of things. You know, he was racing in Chevron Formula 2 cars and Formula 3 cars later on, as well as lots of different rallying. So, you know, Escort Mark, I think he had a Mark 1 or Mark, maybe a Mark 2 Escort and bits and pieces. So, no, you know, I grew up around cars. I grew up around motorsport. I grew up around motorsport people, you know, talking about things all the time. And so it became a big part of my life.
So when did you make the decision? Can you remember how old you were when you were like, I'm doing that too. A daddy's job is cool. I'm doing that.
No, it's a funny one because I never... It just became a natural thing that that's what I was going to do. You know, I never had this point where I sat down and thought, ooh, this is what I am going to do. It was almost a given in my head that this is what I'm going to do. I never thought of doing anything else, which is strange because, you know, it's only when and to be honest, I didn't realize that I was the strange one in that respect. It's only when I got to my mid-20s. And you get to that stage where your peers who are living in the real world, because listen, we don't live in the real world. People, especially racing drivers, but motor racing people in general, we don't live in the real world, right? We don't, normal people don't do 80 flights a year. Normal people don't, you know, don't live in this bubble that we do and exist in the world we do. But it's only when I got to my mid-20s, let's say, and I started meeting my, you know, some of my closest friends are still the ones I went to high school with, and they've gone off to university and done their undergrad degrees, and some of them have got their first jobs, and some of them are, you know, doing their masters or postgraduate degrees, whatever. And they still haven't worked out what they want to do with their lives. And that's actually quite normal. You know, there's a lot of people who get to 23, 24 and don't know yet what they want to be doing for the next 40 years of their life. Yeah. And I couldn't understand that. You know, I'd had these conversations with them and I was like, hang on, you've just studied, you know, biotechnology for 4 years, but now you want to go work in finance? I don't get it. Like, you know, what are you doing? And it's only when I started speaking to more and more people that I realized I was the one who was the oddball, who knew ever since I could remember when I was probably, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 years old, that I wanted to be a racing driver, and I just carried down that path. So yeah, you kind of take things for granted, really, I guess, when you grow up knowing that you've got a single-minded focus on what you want to do and achieve in life.
So let's say, for the sake of argument, humor me here. Let's say you'd gotten your first car or cart or whatever it was, and you were pants. You had no skill behind the wheel at all. Like, none whatsoever. None of the talent, none of the tenacity. You had no skill for racing lines, acceleration. You didn't like it. There was no passion for it whatsoever. What would you be doing now if racing hadn't worked out?
As a driver, if it hadn't worked out as a driver, I would probably be a commentator.
Fair enough.
You know, I genuinely like, you know, commentating on the sport and trying to explain the sport and break it down, because we do have a very complicated sport with a lot of nuances which you're trying to explain to your grandparents at one end of the spectrum, but also the, you know, the young teenagers that you're trying to attract into the sport at the other end of the range. So I think there's an art and a skill to that, and I quite enjoy the challenge of it. But I'd like to think that, you know, my dad in particular, because he was obviously in the sport, was very pragmatic and very realistic. You know, I'd like to think that if I was pants and if I was rubbish at it, he would have told me and we would have stopped. You know, we wouldn't have plowed down the path of breaking the family's financial back for a decade to try and climb the ladder to F1 if we thought I was rubbish. You know, and I think, and that's given me perspective as well. You know, I see that now when I manage and look after young drivers. You know, I'm very direct and very open, and sometimes, you know, I've had the odd driver in tears because I am so direct with them, where I say, listen, you're just wasting money. You're wasting your family's money. You're not going to be a Formula One driver. You're not good enough. Let's just stop now. But I think you have to have that dose of reality, because you can quite easily just spiral in this business, you know, in a dream world that you're going to make it, and you could just spend a lot of time, effort, and money and waste it all. So no, I'd like to think that you know, we had a very pragmatic and realistic approach to it.
No, that's good to hear. I mean, let's talk about the finances, because people always, there's this kind of thing around Formula One where everybody knows it's incredibly kind of challenging to get into, and you often have to do deals with sponsors and so on and so forth in order to be able to fund your existence in Formula One. And there's lots of things like that. So let's play a game if it's cool with you. Imagine that John Markar is the money bags here, and I'm just a young teenage talented driver. How much does John have to spend to get me to the level where I can perform in Formula One? Well, across, say, a 5-year span.
Well,
spend John's money however you want.
If you're talking about,
he's got loads of it.
Yeah. Well, if we say today, because again, don't forget, I climbed this ladder 15, 18 years ago. So, but today, again, it's gotten ridiculously expensive. You know, a season of Formula 4 is now about €600,000. Formula 3 is just under €1 million. So let's say you've got 2 years of that. And then Formula 2 is just under €2 million. You know, so you're knocking on probably €4-5 million before you've got yourself in a position to be ready for Formula 1. You know, so yeah, it's gone. It has, you know, the numbers have gone up exponentially over the last 20 years, especially the lower end of the range as well, especially, you know, in the past, you could do your first season of single seater racing for $100,000. Whereas now it's at $600,000, you know, and I think that's slightly wrong. Yeah. And it goes back to karting. You know, I never did a go-kart race in my life. I never had the opportunity to go karting, because when I grew up in India, we didn't have any karting, and it was a huge disadvantage. I think, you know, if you look at the Hamiltons and Rosbergs and all these guys, they learn so much in karting, don't they? So I think, but now I was talking to somebody the other day who, you know, they're trying to put a program together for their son, and the budget to do the British Championship, not even going across Europe, but to do the British Championship in go-karts is £150,000 or something.
Whoa.
And it's like, what is going on? I mean, the world is going mad.
So what, just to go back to the payment side of things on Formula One, what would a team like Mercedes be spending in a year just to go racing?
Mercedes, so your big three, which are Mercedes, Ferrari, Red Bull, would be upward of €300 million. But now we've got the budget cap that's come in this year. So this is actually, we're talking at a point where we're beginning a new era in F1. There's a budget cap of $145 million. There's lots of exemptions from that. You know, things like marketing and driver salaries and things like that, et cetera. But, you know, all together, it'll still mean that your top teams would spend probably just over $200 million. Per season.
It's just incredible to think about it on that level, isn't it? That is such a mind-blowing amount of money. But then also, I mean, we spoke briefly about Le Mans, and I remember seeing, it may well have been on the build-up to last year's Le Mans 24-hour race, which, if you remember, happened in September without the crowds and everything else. And on the show, the build-up to the show, there was a comment that if you, as a gentleman racer, want to go along and race for the 24-hour, just the 24-hour race now, you are crazy if you're thinking you're spending anything less than £1 million just for that one weekend. That's for you to be a driver, to get in the car. That's not, you know, the team's overall cost. So it is crazy. I often think back to, I remember interviewing many, many, many years ago when I was writing in magazines and interviewing a young racing driver called Jade Edwards, who you may have heard of. And Jade made a really, really good comment and an analogy on the difficulty when it comes to motorsport and the amount of lost talent, I think was the way that she phrased it. Because, of course, the comparison she gave was with football. Any of us really can go out and buy a pair of football boots. It might cost us £30. If you get a really posh set of football boots, it might cost you £100. But ultimately, you can go and buy yourself football boots and a football and go and play football with your friends. And if you mix in the right circles and join the right clubs, there is an opportunity, if you're very talented, to go up through the ranks and get spotted and potentially be a professional footballer. When it comes to motorsport, it's just, It's so far away from that world.
Yeah, but I think that's an unfair comparison, though. I think that's an unfair comparison because, you know, you have to factor in that motorsport is, it's a capital-intensive sport. Mm. It's never going to be a mass sport because you ultimately, you have to buy a machine. You have to make an investment in technology, right? So I think it's fair to compare football to tennis or cricket or basketball or things like that, where you're not, you know, you have to buy, yes, you have to buy bits of equipment, don't get me wrong, but you don't having to actually buy the scale of equipment you have to for motorsport. I think, you know, you can compare motorsport to something like sailing, for example, right? Mm-hmm. Where you have to make an investment in certain amount of kit. So I think, you know, I often hear people say this, you know, this sort of comparison to football. And I think that is unfair because it's never going to be. You have to be realistic here. You can't compare a bottle of Dom Perignon to a bottle of something you buy for £6 in the local corner shop. Mm. You have to talk about apples for apples here.
Yeah, but what about that comparison in talent? You know, you were saying just now that you have to have those very frank and brutal conversations occasionally with drivers where you say, look, I'm really sorry. I know your family putting all this money into it, but it's just not for you. And there may be somebody that can just about scrape together enough money to drive their Renault Clio on a track day every weekend, but they may be the most talented driver in the world. How, you know, is there any hope, do you think, for people that are genuinely talented behind the wheel? And I'm not saying, you know, if you're in your mid-20s or 30s to get into Formula One, because that's, you know, that there is an age cap where it comes to being in the right place at the right time. But do you think there is, in any aspect, an affordable way to get into motorsport for someone with a genuine talent to be spotted and to do well?
I think so. You know, it's a question of what you'd classify as affordable, first of all. But I think there's opportunities to get involved in the sport, right? I that doesn't take away from the fact that I think karting is far too expensive. Don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. I think karting is far too expensive. I think the early rung of the ladder in Formula 4 is far too expensive. I think, you know, ultimately, there has to be a correction. And I know there's work happening in the background to create a more meritocratic way for these kids that you've just mentioned to get into the sport in a more affordable way. Mm-hmm. There's no, you know, I'm not disputing that part. But equally, I think when you look at the current grid of Formula One, there's no lack of talent there, right? There's the depth of talent today on the Formula One grid is very, very strong. You know, you have got, and if you go back across the history of the sport, that's, you know, you've never ever had the entire grid filled with super talented drivers. Mm. They've always been drivers who've got there because they've had better funds than others. Yeah. So that's not changed in the past, and it's not, you know, that wasn't different in the past, and it's not going to change in the future. But I think if we get to a point where we're, you know, running Formula One weekends where you haven't got a talented grid and instead you've only got kids with a lot of money behind them, then we've got a real problem. Whereas today, I don't think that's the case. You know, you could argue that 80% of those drivers who are on that grid could be winning races if they were in the best car. And I think, you know, I think that's ultimately, that's the proof that there is some meritocratic process happening here all the way through.
Well, that obviously leads us to the great Hamilton debate, doesn't it? Because there'll be plenty, you must be acutely aware of this as well. There's a sort of split opinion, isn't there? There's the people like me, I'll put myself, you know, I'm not going to sit on the fence here, that think that Hamilton is one of the most gifted drivers ever. You know, he is next level in terms of talent. And then you've got other people that say, it's the car. Where do you sit?
Oh, he is unquestionably one of the top five greatest drivers of all time. You know, to me, you've got Prost, Senna, Jim Clark, Fangio, Schumacher, Lewis. So that's six there. And the debate of in which order you would rank them, I think you can have lots of pub debates about that. To me, Jimmy Clark is absolutely the number one. But I think there's lots of reasons you can make an argument for every one of those people. No, listen, Lewis is supremely talented. You know, supremely talented, very, very, very experienced now and mature. And I think, you know, if you go back to 2011, 10, 11, 12, whatever, you know, you would see still the odd races where there'd be an error in judgment, where there'd be a mistake, where, you know, sometimes he let his emotions get in the way and make a mistake or something would happen. But that's all gone now, you know, in this, especially I think since 2017, I'd say he's introduced a level of consistency and a level of maturity to the way he goes about a race weekend that leaves him with no weakness. There is no weakness in it now. And I think that's remarkable. You know, he's unquestionably the benchmark today on the grid.
So is he winning 2021, making history?
It'd be impossible to bet against him, wouldn't it? You know, I mean, he's the favorite. he is the favorite. The big question mark is, if Red Bull can deliver a car that's as good as the Mercedes, can Verstappen beat him?
Right.
If you ask me, you know, Max is the only driver today in 2021, because I don't believe Ferrari will be there yet. I think they were quite some way behind last year, the power unit, and I'd be surprised if they come all the way back. But right now, I think your top three drivers have got to be Lewis, Verstappen, and Leclerc, and probably Ricciardo. I'd say those four are your A-plus listers of Formula One.
Because Danny's just moved to McLaren, hasn't he?
That's right, yeah. And I think they've got an interesting year ahead because they've got the Mercedes engine now, which should help them. And they're a team anyway that were on the up. You know, they finished third last year in the Constructors. So I'm really interested to see how McLaren, Mercedes with Daniel gets on this year, actually. So, I think that, you know, any one of those four guys, if we had four identical cars, I'd love to see a race between the four of those guys or a world championship battle between the four of those guys. I think that would be a much harder bet. The trouble is right now, when you ask me, is Lewis going to win in 2021? You also have to remember that Mercedes have got the best car and therefore he probably will.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. Well, and like you say, he just doesn't make these mistakes, does he? It's just, it's almost machine-like these days.
Yeah, it's metronomic, isn't it? You know, week in, week out, you look at people like Max, you know, arguably Turkey last year, he should have won it, made a mistake against Perez. You know, there were a couple of occasions where you thought, yes, he could have and should have snuck in something a little bit better, but didn't. But, you know, there's also that difference, isn't it? You know, Max is, what, 21, 22 now? So, you know, there's, again, as I said before, there's Lewis. Max today is where Lewis was in 2007, 2008. You know, devastatingly fast. Still with the ability to be world champion in the right car, in the right circumstances, but with the odd weekend where he'd make a mistake and it wouldn't happen for him, which we saw with Lewis back then. And he still won the world championship. But I think, you know, with time and experience, and the same with Leclerc, right? You know, we saw Leclerc last year have three first lap incidents, which Lewis doesn't. And I think, again, that's the difference, you know? So, both Leclerc and Verstappen are still relatively inexperienced when compared to Hamilton now. You know, Lewis is going into his 13th, 14th season of F1. So it's a big difference.
It's mad. That makes me feel old.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah.
Are there any names that you're working with, Corinne, that you think are the people to watch for the next few years? Lewis is only a year or two older than I am. And I remember the point that he was debuting and thinking, wow, this is a young guy that's tipped to do such amazing things. And I wonder if everyone's right, you know, with their prediction of how good this guy is. And of course they were, because he is incredible as a driver. Is there anyone that's on your radar now that perhaps the wider world aren't yet aware of that you're really excited to see grow in the motorsport?
Well, I think the world has changed now, isn't it? Because, you know, you've got the internet and social media, et cetera, et cetera. So anyone who's any good is already on everyone's radar.
Yeah.
So I don't think they're those sort of completely hidden, unearthed talents anymore that you've never heard of.
He's forgetting one crucial one there here, John, which is a very heavily backed gentleman in his early 40s who's got big, big funding courtesy of a Mr. Markov. And that is a one Andy. I need a better racing name, Curran. Maybe Andy Von J, something like that. You know.
Well, I happen to know that Andy's very sensitive with criticism. So, Corinne, when you do have to have that conversation about you're wasting John's money, I think you need to really think about how you're going to deliver that.
Yeah, try the cuddly approach rather than the you're rubbish, get out approach.
I think when it comes to racing, I think I'd be all right. I'd be like, yep, no, fair enough. I won't even put the helmet on. You're all good. You're safe. Curran, let's talk about fatherhood, because I don't think we've had this chat since we last.
No, we've been locked up, haven't we? You know, my son's been in lockdown for 50% of his living life. So
yeah,
it's not terrible, really.
That is mad. So as a dad now, you know, knowing you've seen it all in the racing world, you've seen the highs, the lows, and the tragedies, of course, as well. Mm. You've kind of been there and witnessed them all. As a dad, do you have any hopes at all for your son? Are you thinking, I'd love you to follow my footsteps and be on the grid, or would you rather he stayed away?
Well, I was thinking about it the other day. Because, you know, I've got a simulator at home, and he's I was very good for the first 6 months that I never turned it on while he was awake. Mm. But the other day I was doing this workshop. I do a lot of circuit design stuff using the sim. And we were doing this workshop with a client out in Asia. And unfortunately, it had to be in the morning because of the time difference. So obviously he was awake. And it's the first time he saw the sim running, and his eyes just lit up as he saw this race car going around. And ever since then, so, you know, he climbed on my lap. And ever since then, he's had a few goes sitting on my lap, and we drive around the odd track here and there. And he loves it, absolutely loves it. You know, for me, my hesitancy towards him going racing is just the cost of it. You know, I don't think I'm in a position to give him the financial backing he would need to be in the best teams and in the best cars at every level to go there. You know, you never know, right? He's only 2 years old right now. In 10, 12 years' time, there could be driver programs and there could be things that change the whole landscape of it. But to me, that's my hesitancy is purely on the financial standpoint. So my approach is not to push him either way. You know, at the end of the day, he's going to do what he enjoys doing, you know, and he loves doing. Yeah. If he wants to drive a go-kart and if he enjoys driving a go-kart, of course, I'll take him to the kart track and let him have a go, because who am I to stand in the way, right? At the end, you know, my parents didn't do that to me, and it would be unfair for me to do that to him, you know, because it is a fantastic thing to do. But I think I will, from day one, set expectations and explain to him the realities of it. You know, this is what it costs and this is what it is. And, you know, I may be able to afford to take you karting to have the old bit of fun at our local go-kart track and buy you your own kart and have a bit of fun. But I can't afford to pay 150 grand for you to do a British Championship. That's not going to happen. So I think all along I would lay very pragmatic and realistic expectations and just see where that path takes him. You know, I'm not going to push him. I don't think I'm going to push him in either way, and just see how it unfolds. I mean, ideally, if I'm honest, I'd love for him to be a cyclist, because I'm a big cycling fan, and my dream is to get a motorhome and follow the Tour de France for 3 weeks. So if he could be a cyclist and I could do that, it would just be brilliant.
That's, well, I mean, you know, you're in a unique position to be able to encourage that. You can be like, hey, listen, you know, yeah, there's cars, but have you seen Daddy's latest bike?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, he is already, like, when I'm on the turbo trainer, he's already standing there watching me and shouting, pedal, pedal, pedal. And so I'm very aggressively, pushing the cycling and being passive when it comes to the motorsport in either direction.
Awesome.
Well, also, now that you've highlighted the costs, which I, to be fair, I hadn't realised how much karting is. I mean, that's perverse. But now you've highlighted the cost, and the other thing you have to factor in is whether you, whether you're stopping at one or whether you're going to have more children, in which case that will limit their options even further, won't it?
Well, you, I mean, they could end up with a situation like in our house where my brother showed zero interest in motorsport. So he, you know, so fortunately, they only had one son to bankrupt them.
I'd say it's worked out pretty well though, wouldn't you?
Yeah, it's a funny business, isn't it? You spend 10 years spiraling into debt and then you spend the next 10 just barely getting yourself back out of it. Yeah. Now so, you spend 20 years of your life and you're back to ground zero at that point.
But what a journey.
I would not trade it for the world. Don't get me wrong, listen, you know, I was very lucky, as I say, at the age of at the age of 19, 20, I was negotiating when most of my friends were getting pissed at the pub in the uni undergrad dorm rooms or whatever. You know, I was negotiating deals for hundreds of thousands of pounds with race teams and sponsors and going out and making presentations and trying to get people to invest in this journey that I was doing and doing press conferences with 50, 60 journalists and traveling the world and going racing and you know, learning how culturally how to work with a Korean team or with a British team or the German team. And you know, you learn so much in this sport, and that's all of that, of course, is aside from the actual fact of driving the race cars, which is obviously the best bit of it. So no, I think, you know, I wouldn't trade it for the world.
Awesome.
If we could put you back in any car at the start of any race across your career, outcome irrelevant, you get to redo that race, which would you jump into?
If I could redo the race, it would be Le Mans 2014, because I think we could have won our class that year. I was fastest in the test. The car was very, very competitive, and I got caught out in a rainstorm. We were all on slicks going down the straight, and we got caught in a rainstorm, and I think seven of us aquaplaned off under the safety car. The water just got under the belly of the car, no steering, and just aquaplaned off, and that ruined our race. And yeah, I think genuinely that would have been, you know, that was a great chance to win that year. So yeah, if I could go back, I don't know what I would have done differently because I had no brakes or steering or anything at that point as I was sailing down the Monsanto Strait. But, you know, you like to think you could have tried to do something different.
Do you know, I've asked that question to a few different racing drivers and no one ever, they always do exactly the same as you. They choose a race that they didn't quite win. And that's what I do. Rather than going, do you know what, I just loved the experience, or that car in particular was amazing, or I was feeling on top of the world that day, or I just, you know, whatever it might be, like the kind of common things I'd think they'd go for, the atmosphere, the people, the noise, the smell, the whatever it might be. But it's always the race they didn't quite win. Always.
Yeah, because you always want more, isn't it? That's the nature of competitive people. You know, you always want more.
Yeah.
And that's what drives us, really. You know, it's funny because, you know, on the sim, we do these, that our only break from the tedium of lockdown this year has been we've created this little boys group, and we have a little boys night in on a sim night. And we've got a great group of people, you know, it's people like Jason Plato and Anthony Davidson and Dario Franchitti and Darren Turner, you know, lots of racing drivers, basically.
There's some talent showing up to these races.
Yeah, but you know, we stay all under the radar, no streaming and social media and any of that rubbish. It's just boys and banter and hurling abuse and stuff. But we're all just so competitive, and we're all just swearing and getting annoyed with ourselves. And you sometimes have to take a step back and say, oh God, come on, boys. You know, it's just a fun night in with your mates. And instead, we're all just getting more and more angry with ourselves. It's very funny.
It's the whole that it's just a game mentality, isn't it? No, it's not. It's not just a game.
If there's an opportunity to come first, it doesn't matter if it's just a game, because there's an opportunity to come first.
Yeah. But it's with everything, isn't it? You know, I remember, like, as a kid, you know, my brother and I would have races running up the stairs. Everything's a competition, isn't it? Everything turns into competition.
Yeah, definitely.
I would love you to just change it up just for 1 week, Karun, and just instead of doing it on the sim, Mario Kart it.
Well, we have some pretty random combinations, I'll be honest. You know, we raced Mazda MX-5s at Alton Park. We raced some super trucks around some dirt track in Wisconsin the other night.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, I think, you know, we've raced, what else have we done? We went to Mugello with some Indy cars. We raced Lotus 79 somewhere. So, yeah, no, we've done some weird and wonderful combinations.
That's awesome.
Yeah, well, no, that sounds cool, but it's still not going, you know, jumping across a mushroom that makes you invincible.
No.
You know, throwing a red shell at the leader or something. I mean, that'll just for one night.
I know. Maybe.
That's the only thing I can recommend. I'm hopeless at The Sims, but give me a bit of Mario Kart. I'm all there. I'm all in. It's great fun. You've got to give it a try. So what's next for you, Karun? You obviously jump back on the fun bus. Channel 4 again, isn't it, for this year?
No. I've been with Sky now since 2019.
Oh, of course. My bad. Of course. Yes.
And so I'll be back. Back with them, heading to Bahrain for testing in a few weeks' time. So we'll go there. Go to that, and then the season will, you know, obviously we've got a calendar of 23 races. How many we actually get, we'll wait and see. You know, I think, to be fair, it looks like the vaccine rollout is going better in the UK than it is in a lot of other countries at the moment. So, you know, fingers crossed for us that it keeps going in that direction. But yeah, you know, I'll carry on with that. Carrying on with Williams, doing stuff with the Heritage Program. Got a few projects still with the circuit design company I work with, Driven International, based in Surrey. So we've got a few projects on the go with that, which keeps me busy in between races. There's a few irons in the fire, as always. You know, writing bits and pieces for Autosport and things like that.
You always just seem so incredibly busy. I'm always thinking to myself, well, have you got assistants here? Because there's so much. You know, I'll see you at a circuit and then there'll be an article dropping and then there's all sorts of other things going on. I'm just like, well, I mean, do you sleep? How do you fit it all in?
Well, it's just good to be busy, isn't it? You know, I think when you're not busy, then you're in trouble in this business. So, you know, I think it's the nature of it, isn't it? You know what it's like, you know, when you work for yourself and you recognize and you realize all of a sudden when you haven't got, if you got a day without any work on, you start to worry a little bit, haven't you? So it's always in the back of your head to make sure that you've got things going on.
Yeah, although I wouldn't mind a couple without any on just once in a while.
yeah, of course. Listen, you know, obviously. But I think lockdown has changed and the whole COVID thing in the last year has changed the way we all approach life, isn't it? In the way we balance family life and work life and with the way we're operating, the way we're working, look at how we're doing this podcast. We're all sitting in three different places. We'd never do that in the past, which I think, you know, there's pluses and minuses. It's, you know, the remote recording helps us all I'm sure it helps you guys get access to guests that you wouldn't otherwise get because they can do it from their own house. But on the flip side, I quite like sitting around a table with other people and you know, having a chat. You lose a layer of that connection, don't you, by staring at each other like we're doing now over a computer screen. So, you know, there's lots of different things I think we've all learned from the last 18 months.
Yeah. No, it's been a weird time, and I'm still not convinced that the world is going to turn as we're all expecting it to quite in the same way ever again, actually, but we'll see. I think Formula One will be safe in a sort of perverse way. You sort of think of all the sports that probably will be able to continue, maybe not with crowds in 2021, but, you know, at some point they'll probably be able to reintroduce them and give them a different way of working and so on. But, you suspect that the resilience of something like a Formula One will definitely without, I'd have thought. Mm. It's too big to fail, isn't it?
Listen, everything can fail, right? You can never be complacent and think that you're too big to fail. But I think F1 have done a brilliant job. They've worked very, very hard at making sure that the races ran last year. I mean, it's incredible to do those 17 races. You know, the logistics operation of getting all of us, you know, there's 3,000 of us who travel, getting COVID tested every 5 days and all that sort of stuff. You know, the logistics involved and the paperwork involved for all of us to be going to the test centers and making sure you're on charter flights and making sure that, you know, we got exemptions when we land in all these different countries and we can come back home and come back to our families, but come back safe. So you have to make sure you're tested before you get on the plane. And, you know, there's all these things. But they did a, if you look at the global, across global sport, you know, they did a remarkable job. By far, I think, the benchmark of any sport in the world.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree further. Actually, they were the level to aspire to. You know, the people are getting it right. They absolutely nailed it in the logistics of Formula One. Corinne, I'm mindful of how long we've chatted for, and I know that we're kind of tight on time now. So I just have one last question for you, if that's all right. And it sort of came back to me. We were chatting, John and I were chatting with Nikki Shields recently, who I know you know, who's just lovely. And you mentioned earlier in our conversation, you know everybody, and you're so connected in this world. One of the things that came up was Extreme E, which I'm still sort of slightly confused about, to be honest, the idea of racing on polar ice caps in order to bring awareness to polar ice caps. It still sort of strikes me as being a bit nuts. But you probably know a lot more about it than I do. And the machinery involved looks amazing. Some of the names involved, Jensen himself is going to be racing. Do you think this is going to be a sort of a series to watch? Is it going to be quality?
Listen, the one thing I do know is Alejandro Agag, who's behind it, he seems to have a bit of a Midas touch, doesn't he? You know, he's a very, very smart and shrewd operator. And he's got a very strong marketing and PR message. You know, the way he goes about things is very, very impressive. So he's done a great job roping in, you know, as you say, great team names, people like Lewis and Jensen and Rosberg and Andretti and Ganassi. You know, there's some great teams who have gotten involved in it.
Carlos Sainz as well.
Carlos Sainz is driving. Sainz, yeah, I think there's going to be some very entertaining racing. The locations look pretty spectacular from what he's shown me. It'll be interesting to see, won't it? It's going to be different. It's going to be radically different. We'll see how it. See how it plays out. I mean, I suspect that actually, you know, the person who would be most excited to go along to it would be Amy, because the photography opportunities on Extreme E look incredible, don't they? When you look at the locations they're going to, I bet that it looks pretty stunning.
Yes, absolutely. Although I don't know if she'd be thrilled about the idea of spending 6 months on a cruise liner, which I think a lot of the teams and the vehicles, etc., are having to do, aren't they?
Oh, I didn't realize. I thought it was just the vehicles. I didn't realize the people are staying on there as well. Oh, wow. That's a big commitment.
I think so. Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's not a sort of presenting gig you'd want, is it? You know, you'd be like, there you go, you can cover the races. Okay, where am I staying? On the boat. What? All the time? Yeah. All right. Now you're all right. I'm not saying that's what they've offered, by the way. I'm just imagining that's the pitch.
It would be tough, though, wouldn't it? I mean, I struggle with the 45-minute sailing from Dover to Dunkirk. I couldn't imagine having to spend 6 months on a damn boat, even if it does mean a bit of motorsport in between.
Yeah, but I suppose sailors do it, though, don't they?
Yeah, like, because they like it.
Yeah. I guess so.
Yeah, I mean, there will obviously be exceptions. You know, you're not going to have your Jensens and your King Carloses and so on and so forth living on the boat. But I think, you know, a lot of key team members, I think, are expected to. I might be totally wrong, Corinne. You probably have much more detail and tell me I'm completely wrong. But that's, I might be misreading it, but that was my understanding. A fair percentage of them will be on that boat.
I'm sure you'll be able to dip in and out. I can't imagine Jensen's going to be living on that boat for 6 months.
No, he's not.
It looks, from all the trailers you see, it looks pretty spectacular, doesn't it?
It does, yeah.
It does. It's definitely piqued my interest, that's for sure. You know, I can't stop thinking about it, partly because I think the cars look seriously cool. I mean, it's a big factor, isn't it? But look, listen, Karen, you've given us so much of your time today, and what a pleasure. I knew it would be good talking to you. I remember when I said to John, hey, listen, he might come on the pod. We were like, oh! Hands together moment. So, and you haven't disappointed, man. Thank you so much for your company. It's been a real pleasure.
No, absolutely a pleasure to chat with you guys. Happy to come along at any point and keep the podcast coming. You know, as long as we're all locked up and locked down, it's keeping me entertained, that's for sure.
Oh, that's good. Well, let's hope then we can look forward to a time where we can all be sat around a table together as well, because you're so right. It's, you know, doing them remotely is great, and it does mean that we can speak to people that often at a bit of an ad hoc basis, but there is no comparison to being sat around a table together. So let's
well, the last podcast I did before lockdown started last year, we did it at my local pub. I did a podcast with the race, and we thought, you know what? We used to do it in my living room, and I had a deal where I had to organize carrot cake, because that's the boys were, you know, they had this thing, the obsession with carrot cake. And then I said, you know what? Let's mix it up. Let's go to the local pub, and it was brilliant. It's just not, you know, it was great. We took the recording equipment. We all sat around a quiet corner in the pub. And we had the fire, you know, the fire in the corner, and I thought, this is actually quite nice. You know, this is a justifiable working lunch here. So yeah, it'll be nice to go down to the pub for one of them.
Absolutely, you've made that sound like it's a different world.
And you'll have to bring Amy along, because I need to discuss minis with an expert, because I've suddenly got this bee in my bonnet about wanting to buy an old mini. And I need to discuss that with an expert.
Now, that's a deal. That is a deal we can definitely make, because, yeah, Amy and minis are kind of hand in glove. So you got it, man. As soon as the world is turning again, that pub with the fireplace and the carrot cake and Amy and our slot, it's a date.
Excellent. Look forward to it.
Thank you so much, Corinne. You have a wonderful rest of your
guys.
Day. Take it easy. Thank you.
Cheers.
The Driven Chat podcast in association with Paramex Digital.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Oh, wow. You've made it to the end. The very end. And it's John Markar here again, reminding you that this podcast, the Driven Chat podcast, has now run its course and has come to an end. To find the new format, search the Driven podcast in your preferred podcast app, or head on over to the website driven.site to find some quick and easy links through to the new episodes in the new formats on your preferred apps. Thanks. Bye.